On the podcast today, we are going to speak about the advanced spiritual practice of Aspasya. Now, Aspasya we find in the Mandukya Karika, going all the way back to Gaudapada, who is Shankara's teacher's teacher. And so this concept we find through the whole lineage of Shankara, so through the practice of Advaita Vedanta, but also this practice relates to other spiritual traditions. We actually find Aspasya in Mahayana Buddhism and other Buddhist paths. And so Aspasya technically is kind of a direct path. And as I said, it's an advanced spiritual practice. So if you're new to spirituality, then this will get you quicker to the destination, understanding Aspasya. And if we say that there is a destination, but it'll advance your spiritual process and understanding Aspasya. So Aspasya basically is the yoga of no contact. Aspasya literally means no relation to anything. So this doesn't mean like an ultimate aloneness or loneliness, but you could probably look at it in that sense when you understand a lot more about what we're going to speak about in this podcast. But so Aspasya means, yes, no relation to anything, so or contact with anything. Now, touch implies duality, right? Like I can touch you. So physically, if touch implies duality, but Gaudapada is talking about the mind, right? He's talking about don't touch the mind, don't touch the thoughts.
Yes, yeah, no contact on your own mind and any object, any experience, anything that you attach to, basically.
Yes.
No relation to a person, object, or the experience, or even your own self-image, your own mind, your memories, the past, everything.
Because Gaudapada and Shankara would both say that the jiva, the person, your persona, is an object. And it is, in a sense, when you think about it, because it's an accumulative sense of self that you've gathered through your present life, and you have all of these quirks about yourself and these things that you like and you dislike and so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. So it's like an object. And we have to understand the mind in a real proper Eastern sense, right? Like, because when a lot of people say the mind, especially in Advaita Vedanta, we've seen this at satsangs and this and that, there's a very warped understanding of the mind. And when they speak about the mind, they're really talking about the contents of the mind, because the nature of the mind is empty, spontaneous, and free, but the mind has this habit to solidify itself. So it accumulates, you know, name, form. It's a victim of nama rupa, right? Like, to use Buddhist terminology, we've got to label our experience. We've got to create a persona for ourselves. And it's all invested in self-interest and self-preservation, actually. It's our own survival.
Yeah. It's a solidified itself. And problem is that us choosing to give attention to those things, and that which makes it concrete and solidify, and we identify the contents of the mind.
Yeah. Right? That's right. And so that's the kind of the relation that Gaudapada and Shankara are talking about, relating to these objects within the mind. Now, as I said, the mind is naturally empty, spontaneous, and free. That's when it's as empty as that, as they say in yoga, yoga chitta vritti nirodha, you can see right into the nature of your mind and understand that you are actually Brahman. The jiva is a construct. And the jiva implies separation, implies duality, even between yourself and the ultimate reality. And this is it's addressed actually in the Mandukya Upanishad, that because we can say it's Aspasya yoga, right? But yoga implies duality. The yogic path is a dual path. Patanjali yoga here is a path of duality. So saying Aspasya yoga is kind of contradictory, but at the same time, Gaudapada is using it in his own context in that certain period of time. So meaning union with the ultimate reality, or the, we could say, the realization you've always been the ultimate reality, so to speak.
And also maybe it can be used in terms of like a disciplinary method.
Exactly. Well, it can be, yeah. Like, you know, let's look at the ways of attaining aspasya. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so if you were going to engage in aspasya, you need vairagya, right? You need renunciation of worldliness, and you also need pratyahara. You need to withdraw the senses, to use yogic terminology, which allows you then to dharana, to concentrate better, to have jhana, to be absorbed in the self, right? So we need that sort of practice as well.
Yeah.
So they, again, complement aspasya. And so, but you have to really understand that, because vairagya, meaning you've haven't renounced the physical world, you've renounced the world in your mind that you've created for yourself, the maya, the measurement of reality that you've created. And we all measure reality differently, actually. Like, you experience something different in some sense to me. And we all do that because of our own personal jiva.
Yeah.
And so it's about renouncing that. And to help the renunciation of that, you have to withdraw the senses from the pull of the physical world, you know, trying to get you engaged in relationships.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think this is somewhat related to Zhuangzi's philosophy of having a non-sticky mind, I think. Being sticky means, again, like having that habit of associating things, objects, experience, thoughts, or people in your life somewhat comes to your mind in not necessarily disturbs your way of thinking, but it has its influence to your mind, and certain things sticks to your mind, right? Mm-hmm. That's, again, being aspasya.
Aspasya, I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
All relation.
Yeah, all relation, all associated in
yeah.
this and that. So, again, the practice of aspasya yoga is to have the non-sticky mind. And again, like, to fully be able to absorb your pure consciousness and your pure presence, existence, and that recognition of itself, it will help you to keep the aspasya, right? So having the non-sticky mind.
Yeah, it's a good point, because Zhuangzi is saying that we're going around labeling everything, right? We're naming everything to suit our own persona, because that reinforces our own worldview of the world.
Yeah.
This makes me feel safe in this world because I have this scaffolding in my mind, but you can't see the infinite of the Tao. You know, all you see is, you know, a multitude of the 10,000 things.
Yes.
And according to the way you see it.
Yeah.
And like you said, with the sticky mind, our mind is kind of like that, right? It's like, like one of those, you know, those dust things that all the dust sticks to. It's like our mind is like that going through life, where, and things are just are sticking, and then we think that that's who we are, because that becomes then hard and becomes the becomes the contents of our mind, and that's how we, you know, create our world, right?
Yeah.
Or our worldview, and so. We have to talk about that, like, in the modern day, like, because this is really a strange practice in consideration, especially when we talk in the modern day, and it's even more difficult now, right? Because to practice aspasya, you can't have relation to anything in your mind. And so we're talking about thoughts, we're talking about persona and this and that. So we're talking about no relation at all. And we're talking about the end of our story.
Yeah.
So the story is Guy Young, the story is Jason, the story is everyone who was watching and listening. That has to end. The story cannot go on.
Mm-hmm.
And so we live in a world now, though, where it's built on a lot of relationships.
Yes.
With through social media. Yes. It's all about relationships.
And constant stories of yourself and others, right?
Exactly. Mm. We're constantly posting images and this and that on social media to reinforce ourselves, to tell our story to others. And then the irony here is then we become so invested in the stories of other people.
Mm.
You know, so we're invested then in other people's stories because we're on social media looking at images and so forth.
I mean, it's somewhat, it's a subconsciously, we are in constant competition with others, I think, yes. In each different social media platform that, I mean, who got more likes, who got more comments and love hearts and this and that. Mm. I mean, this has been going on for a long time, but nowadays it became so subtle and became so much of part of people's mind, I think. Mm. It's more than ever, almost becoming like they're complete different online persona they want to create for their own satisfaction and for themselves and for the eyes of others as well, that all these picture-based platform or yeah. All these, you know, like really catchy short video-based platform and this and that, it's all self-promoting mm-hmm. platform basically mm-hmm. and who gets most attention. Yep. That is to say who got most interesting story, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that,
not that it's a true story.
That's what I was going to say. That whatever story, whether that's true or false, that's not the concern. Who got the most like a stimulating story, most interesting, fun story, like so that you don't, that shows that you not necessarily need to be true to yourself in real life. If you present yourself reasonably persuasive on social media, then you're so-called successful then, right? Unfortunately.
Yeah. It's an addiction, right? The telling the story, and no matter if it's true or false, is an addiction. So, and we've talked about this many times on the podcast, that this image that people portray on social media is often not an accurate description of who they are or their real story. It's a story of who they think they ought to be or who they want to be. That's what they portray on social media. It's not actually who they, or I shouldn't say who they truly are. It's not their actual story. You know, it's an image of who they think they want to be. And that's often the case on social media. We all know that because you've met people from social media, probably most of us have, in the flesh, and how they portray themselves on social media and how they are in reality are completely different, two different stories. And so we're in this bad habit in the modern day of this sense of telling our story and being related to everything then. Like we're trying to relate ourselves to other things, and then you get in this addiction and this game where it's hard to get out because you're addicted to connectivity.
Yes.
And the connectivity in and of itself is not real authentic connectivity too, because it's usually you're connected to people you've never known before. And it's not to say that there aren't positive things about social media and this and that. There obviously are. But in this respect, it isn't, because you get in a bad psychological state of falsity and hypocrisy. And this is where the mind dwells then, in this sort of falsity and hypocrisy. That's not genuine, right?
What I believe that people are so unaware about the social media is that there's a huge danger in the social media, I think. As we all know, the social media platform, each flat platforms gets upgraded, gets smarter and smarter on their own, so that it tricks, they already had the tricks on the system to build the interest within people, right? And these platforms got smarter and smarter. How do we get more interest from people? How do we get to have more people on the platform? And how do we get people locked in the platform? And it's getting ever smarter and smarter, so that the relationship that we have with these other, I would say, just IDs on the social media platforms become ever too vast and also ever gets, because of these platforms get smarter and smarter, people get lost and gets much more complicated.
Yes, yes.
So that's why I think this is actually very, very dangerous to our mind. That is why these ancient wisdom traditions becomes harder and harder for people to practice. It, these concepts, again, let's say even 50 years ago from now, this knowledge wouldn't be as hard as now to grasp for just average public people, right? But now we are so far away from it, and we are ever diverse world that we ever had. And we can be friends with someone from somewhere like French Guiana or something like that you never ever met. And ever like increased connectivities that we can have. And you can go as far as you want in that world if you want. Yeah. So that it gets so complex and complicated, which splits our mind constantly. So that these path of these spiritual practices becoming much more difficult for a lot of people, I think.
It's true. It's true. Well, the pleasures are far more sophisticated this day and age, right? Like with social media and this and that, like what you're saying. And it's a constant practice of sparsha. Not a sparsha, it's a constant practice of relating yourself to or touching and connecting with everything and anyone, not just your story, but externally as well.
As much as possible.
As much as possible. So, and as you're alluding to, we are more connected than ever, but we are more lost than ever.
100%.
And that's ironic, right? 100%. Like we have all this connectivity, but we're more lost than ever. You see people fighting online and this and that, and no one's really contemplative. And so like you were saying, like with a sparsha, imagine you mention a sparsha to someone. It's right over the head because it doesn't make sense. Because the whole world that we have now is built on relationships. It's built on sparsha, not a sparsha. And so the practice of a sparsha is not about exploring your story. It's about exploring existence itself. So when we look at Sat Chit Ananda in Sanskrit, it's about exploring the sat, the very existence of your being, of everyone's being. That's what it's about. And so to explore that, you cannot have a relationship to any object because that implies duality. That implies duality. And I know that we, most people are living this day and age with a dualistic mind, but that is actually not how reality is according to the spiritual traditions.
Dualistic reality exists. We know it. But that's just one level of understanding, one level of perception. But elevated perception, and from that level, it's the ultimate reality itself is not dual. And that requires to see from above.
So then you have to say, does the duality really exist then? That's what the Vedantins
will
say.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Because if the reality is Brahman, then it's, you know, it's like that Shankara quote, you know.
Does it really exist?
Does it really exist? Mm-hmm. You know, it only exists, according to Shankara, when we see it as Brahman. So when you're seeing it as dual, it's Maya.
Yep.
So you are looking at the world and you are dissecting it into this and that. This is the dualistic mind. That doesn't really exist because all that really exists is Brahman itself. So it's about perceiving it as Brahman. And that's why a sparsha is about the sort of the cleansing of the seer and the seen. You know what I mean? So what happens when, you know, we talked about the mind before, when we get rid of all of the contents of the mind and we clean the basement of the mind out, it's all gone. What's left? It's just awareness. It's just pure awareness is left. So the seer then sees the reality as it is, not as we think it should be. So I see Gayang and I think that she is like this and this and that. I have all my own projections, right? But that's not the way, actually, the way it truly is. And so once we get rid of the contents of our mind, we see the reality as it is, empty of qualities.
Yes.
So Naguna Brahman,
yes.
See? It's not Saguna Brahman. It's not with qualities, it's empty of qualities. And essentially from that place, because this is similar to Shunyata also in Buddhism, nothing then has a existence in and of itself.
Yes.
It's because it's all one thing. It doesn't really have an existence. It has a story.
Yes.
And it believes this story. But it's not true story.
No.
It's like you're watching a fiction film.
Yeah, based on fiction story, not true story.
Yeah, exactly. Based on a fiction story, yeah. Not based on a true story. So that's really what's happening here, see? So the awareness you are disentangling your awareness from this, the objects of mind and the objects of the external world, the gravitational pull that the external world has on our mind. So you're disentangling your awareness from that to then see reality as it is. And when you see reality as it is, what's there to say about it, you know?
It's almost like that the dualistic point of view is purely come from our like belief, which is from our like delusional mind.
It's jiva.
It's just a belief that's not true.
Yes. So your jiva is measuring the world, and your jiva is saying the dualistic world exists, and this is the way it is. And it's like, okay, Gaudapada and Shankara come, I see where you're coming from, but let's examine the nature of the jiva that says that first.
Right.
And so if we examine the nature of the nature of the jiva is empty. It doesn't really exist. It's a story you've created. It's an accumulative story that you've built throughout your life that is temporary, and it's not actually the foundation or the substratum of existence itself. Mm. So that's where they're coming. That's where they're coming from, Gaudapada and Shankara.
Mm.
So that's why they say that reality is not actually really non-dual, even though we're experiencing it in some sense in a dualistic manner through our minds. Subjectively, it doesn't really exist, you know.
So this physical reality that we are experiencing throughout our lives is, again, like just one level of reality.
Yeah.
And one level of reality with the physical existence, physical, like 10,000 things.
Yes.
Like,
So like what Gaudapada and Shankara would say is, aspāśara, you're not touching the objects, right, of your mind especially, but you're also not touching the subject of the one who experiences those objects. You're not touching the subject or the object.
Mm.
That's what aspāśara is. So when you follow that line of thought or that way of practice, what's then left? So when you're not touching the subject, you're not touching the objects of your mind.
Just pure consciousness.
Just pure consciousness. So is it dual? Is it non-dual? Is it related to anything? Or is it as it is? And that's where that's what Gaudapada and Shankara are trying to explain.
That's why in the Mandukya it says it was never born, it was unborn, ever present.
Ever present. Mm. Had no birth. Beyond birth.
Yeah, the omniscient Brahman.
Yep. Mm. Beyond birth, beyond rebirth, beyond life, beyond existence itself. Was never born.
Mm.
Can never die. So this idea of there is only Brahman, especially from the Advaita Vedantic perspective of Gaudapada and Shankara, can be very fearful for a lot of people who don't understand the knowledge and are not trained in especially Advaita Vedanta. And Gaudapada actually speaks about this in the Mandukya Upanishad Karaka. And so he has actually, it states, this yoga, aspāśara yoga, which is not in touch with anything, is hard to be attained by all yogis in general. The yogis are afraid of it, for they see fear in it where there is really fearlessness.
Mm.
And so Gaudapada is mentioning, is speaking about yogis here in the context of what we've been talking about, from the Patanjali path.
Yep.
So the traditional yogic path is, well, not traditional, but the so-called classical yogic path is a dualistic path. And so the yogis here see fear in the end of, you know, in this aspāśara yoga, because they themselves fear the end of their own individual consciousness, you know, their own individual experience. That's kind of a step almost too far for them to comprehend. There's a lot of fear that arises there.
Is that the fear that, like, their own existence, if that existence gets annihilated.
Annihilated, yeah. Yeah, they fear that.
Mm.
And see, what Gaudapada and Shankara are trying to explain to the yogis is that fear can only arise in duality. It happens through sparsha, through touch.
Mm.
Where a sparsha, that's why Gaudapada says in the end, they see fear in it where there is really fearlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you've come to that sparsha state, you're in a non-dual state.
Mm.
You're all that is, all that ever was.
Mm.
You're not the story anymore. You've merged with Brahman.
Mm.
No fear can arise because there's no touch. Because fear can only arise through touch. But see, the yogis, and for a lot of people in general, that's a step too far. You know, because one thing that a lot of people fear most on the spiritual path is the end of their story, their own individual consciousness. What about the one who's done all this spiritual practice for the years and I've attained certain siddhis and samadhis? And what about me? Shouldn't I get some recognition?
I think deepest fear arises from us not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
Like not knowing of anything gives you fear, I think. That's why biggest fear, people say biggest fear for anyone is death. Because after death, you don't know what's happening. If there is anything to happen, what's next?
Yeah.
Nobody knows.
Yeah.
And literally nobody knows. We can only speculate.
Fear of the unknown.
Fear of the unknown, yes. That's what it is.
Mm.
I think, again, like you mentioned before, like what about me? What about all this knowledge I've learned and this and that? And like, what about my own existence and this and that? Then end of your own existence and then what? That's and also like a fear of losing so-called your own existence.
Yeah, your own identity. You
know? Yes, that's right. Again, psychologically we build our own identity associating with relationship and environment, right? So once your immediate environment, whatever environment that create your identity and the people around you, relationships that create identity of yourself, are under threat, you become anxious, you have a bit of a breakdown somewhat, like who am I, why am I doing this? And you start questioning these things, which is, I think is very good.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So that's then this fear comes in, like what's the place for me in this world, this kind of thing. Again, we always find ourselves in the relation-based.
Yeah.
But this one is a break completely out of all of that. So initially, I think there is fear for anyone. But again, like in the Upanishad said, that actually there is only fearlessness. Because once even your existence gets evaporated to that nothingness, what's there?
Yeah.
Nothing, really. So that this dual existence, dual reality is only from our illusion, deluded perception, which is very limited. But then once you go above that, once we realize that there is only Brahman.
There's only Brahman, yeah.
Then there's nothing to fear of, right?
No.
Yeah.
And like you were saying with the fear of that arises with relationships, what's the crux of that? Attachment.
Ah, yep.
So see, with sparsha, with touch, there is attachment. So we're attached to, you know, knowledge we have, people we know, everything. We are, like you said before, we're stuck. Our mind is like super glue on everything. And so we are attached then to the, especially the relationships, the human relationships we have, and the relationship we have ultimately with ourselves or our story. That's the ultimate attachment. Because with that attachment, then you can be attached to other things. And so asparsha is saying to detach from that story, which then, so with that one thought, you resolve all other attachments, you see.
It's a very important point, but it's also extremely difficult to do it, I think, because, like, again, whatever circumstance that's happening around you, or right now or in the past, that creates a certain image in yourself with the emotional experience that you had at that very moment. Mm. So whatever similar situation happens, that same emotion comes up.
Mm.
Or vice versa. You have a similar emotion, you experience a similar emotion, then that very specific experience comes up from your memory.
Mm.
So it's very quick and split second of subconscious mind behavior, I think.
Yes.
But we need to cut that chain.
Yeah.
But that's inevitable. That's no option, I think.
Mm.
You have to. That's why this study is important. That's why these spiritual disciplines are important.
Yeah. Mm. See, what you're saying, and also to what the yogis were saying, they can handle death, but they can't handle death while living to become a jivanmukta. They can't handle to be liberated in this life, which means you have to kill your story. The story of yourself has to die, which then resolves all the attachments. But we can handle physical death because, you know, you die and you got cancer and this and that. And it's
I don't know. We handle it. It just happens.
Yeah, I know, but you know what I mean. Handle it in that sense. It's happening to me. I have to do my best.
In the end, we all accept it.
We accept it. But accepting this death is
very difficult.
It's difficult because, as the yogis point out, you fear the death of your own individual consciousness, in a sense. You know, you say, it doesn't mean that you won't have, you know, this is the problem that I think a lot of people have. It doesn't mean you won't have this sort of subjective experience. It means that the story is ended, though. So the identity itself may still exist, but it's the belief in the identity that's died. You know that this story is not a true story. It's not a true story, you know what I mean? It came with a disclaimer before the movie. So it's a
fiction story.
It's a fiction story, based on a fiction story. So,
that's pretty funny. Your story in your mind is not based on true story.
No.
If it was based on true story, it's a Brahman story, right?
Exactly.
None of that memories, the emotion attached to it was real.
Yeah.
Based on fiction story. Why? Because you relate your emotions and your feelings and your past memories of before that, you put it all together and you build your own story.
Yes.
And you're creating your own version of story.
Yeah.
So that if you were to say that sort of whatever happened in your life as a form of story to someone else, but then someone else would not take it as bad as you would have made you already have made of, right? Mm. So
exactly. It's pretty funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's the thing, like it's you know, like I think that the yogis and, you know, all of us actually, like our individual consciousness is the pivot of all the enjoyments we have in the world. So it's like how we experience the world and we enjoy the world, right?
Yep.
This doesn't mean that you find a sparsha and you don't enjoy the world. That's not what I'm saying. But that's where the fear arises, because the yogis think that that's the end.
Mm.
But as you know, with a proper jivanmukta, for example, or an avadutta, someone who is liberated in this life, is they experience life just in a flow. It's just happening to them, and they're not attached to it, and they go through life because they have a mind of no deliberation. It's not stuck anywhere. They're just like, this is awesome, you know. It's like that. It's like the butterfly chapter in the Zhuangzi. They're not attached to the transitions of life. They move freely with the transitions of life, and that's what, you know, most of us on the spiritual path don't understand, and the yogis back in the day in Gaudapada's time didn't understand as well, because they thought, they just feared that if I disappear, I will not enjoy life anymore. And Gaudapada is saying you'll enjoy life even more because the story of yourself is not touching the reality you are so-called experiencing. You are moving as one with the reality then, as the reality, as Brahman.
That person who disappears is an artificial I.
Artificial.
That's eye, what disappearing.
Exactly.
Then once that I is disappeared, then you can fully enjoy life as it is, without attachment, without any prejudgment and prejudices. Yes.
Exactly, exactly. And that's why self-inquiry, vichara, in especially, you know, for those who know self-inquiry through Ramana Maharshi, is a practice that is basically the same as aspasya. It's about, you know, observing the eye, isolating the eye, and realizing that the eye is just an accumulated sense of self with all of these qualities that were acquired through your life. And, you know, we often, you know, we're always describing ourselves as, I am like this or I am like that. But are you really, you know? And that's what you investigate in self-inquiry, and you investigate when you practice aspasya. You're investigating, am I really like that? Or is that just the story I've been reinforcing myself through my whole life? You might have had one experience when you were a 10-year-old, and you keep telling yourself that story until you're 60. Oh, no, I'm just like this. And then if you go back in time, you're like, why am I really like that? Well, I had one experience like this, and I think that I'm like that because of this one experience. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? So, but that's how we all live our life. We create the story of ourselves, and then we superimpose qualities onto that, saying that we are like this and we are like that. And then when you isolate the eye, like you were mentioning, then you realize that this eye is manufactured, doesn't exist. And so self-inquiry aspasya is about getting rid of all of these qualities and exposing the you know, based on a fiction story.
Yeah, exactly.
So
again, like the most important thing with this aspasya yoga is to, again, detaching what's in your mind.
Yeah.
That you constantly constantly consciously, unconsciously get in touch with within whatever it's in your mind.
Yep.
Like you said, people create their own stories of their habits and dislikes and likes and this and that, and they solidify that's who they are, and they keep repeating themselves. That's why I somewhat think that everyone is at certain level or pretty stubborn.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, for sure.
We don't want to admit that things can change.
Yes, for sure.
Right? For the better. But for some reason, we like to stick to one way and we just want to repeat it and repeat it no matter what. And although some variables happened in your life, whether that's obstacles in your life or something, which gives you sign for you to make a difference in your habits or way of thinking and whatnot, the people often ignore it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that stubbornness has to go away. I find it with myself a lot that you have to acknowledge that you are somewhat stubborn and a little bit selfish, but you have to move forward, you have to go away from it.
Yeah, I think stubbornness and also cynicism is a big part of people's lives these days, and especially when, you know, we find that about ourselves when we practice spirituality, spiritual cultivation, or any sort of internal art or deep meditation. You realize that I am a stubborn son of a gun, and I am cynical about a lot of things that I don't really know about, and, you know, so why am I cynical about those things, and so forth and so on, right? Like, there's so many things about ourselves that we create through our story which affect the way we experience reality.
I think to practice any spiritual disciplines, I think two things are very important, which is a obvious intellectual part of it, which is based on knowledge, and the other is an emotional part of it. I think that stubbornness and like a deep I don't know, yeah, stubbornness, being conservative somewhat, that is coming from, you are emotionally not free, I think. So that to be able to have a balanced and healthy emotion is to have the trust in the world, or like in this sense, like a love of God, love of Brahman, like itself. So which can go to the bhakti path. That again, the bhakti path is an path of liberation through your emotional center. I think so that to merge between the outer world, to merge between the Brahman world and ourselves emotionally, we have to be connected as well, I think. And so that have like a lust and like a cynicism of the world and stubbornness and this, and it comes from distrust of the world, I think. So that is actually cannot be ignored, which is very important, I think. And of course, that knowledge could be self-knowledge from your own practices and discipline, or coming from actual study of ancient scriptures and philosophies and things like that. Which, and so once the two goes together, once it works together, and you have healthy balance, and that's again how our brain functions, that our emotional center and our cognition go bounce each other, so that we're giving good healthy knowledge creates good balanced emotion, vice versa. So I think these things are important.
It's an embodied cognition, like even saying, you know, the cold cognition and the hot cognition, from the Eastern perspective, it's one mind. Obviously, they acknowledge that we have those, but it's embodied, you know. And as you were saying with bhakti, this is why in the Bhagavad Gita, they explain karma, bhakti, and jnana, because those three traditional yogic paths, we as a spiritual aspirant, you should have all three of those turned on. So obviously, the bhakti, taking care of the emotional center, will help you have a more of a love and appreciation for the world in general, not just for Brahman or Vishnu or Shiva or whatever deity you worship, but it allows you to, you know, be emotionally, have a clean emotional center where you have a love and an appreciation, gratitude for life itself. Karma meaning that you act in an appropriate way in the world, you know what I mean? Like you are a fully functioning and sane and healthy individual who acts as a normal human being should. And obviously jnana is, you know, knowledge of Brahman. And so, you know, obviously in Advaita, there's a big focus on the knowledge of Brahman, the jnana perspective. It is a path of jnana yoga, but it's not that they, in Advaita Vedanta, they don't exclude bhakti and karma. Like they will say that if you have, it's sometimes good to have a little bit of bhakti, a little bit of karma to enhance your jnana.
Yes.
You know, Shankara does say that ultimately you have to follow the path of jnana. If you want to, because jnana means the knowledge of Brahman, you know, you need to practice aspasya to have the knowledge of Brahman.
Yes.
And so, but in saying that, like we were saying, like if you have a little bit of sprinkle of bhakti, a little sprinkle of karma, you're going to be a healthy, functioning human being and not a crazy person, you know, waxing lyrical about spirituality. And so, and that brings us to like the sort of the last stage of the practice in aspasya, where, and this is the last hurdle for everyone, right? Like, you know, we can practice karma and bhakti and jnana and that as much as we want. The knowledge of Brahman means, to complete the process of aspasya, the one who contemplates, who is the contemplative of aspasya or of Brahman, they themselves have to disappear as well. So not I am Brahman, it's Brahman without the I.
Yes.
Has to disappear.
That's right.
And that's the final hurdle in the aspasya practice of pure witnessing, because aspasya is basically a practice of pure witnessing, same as self-inquiry, right? Vichara, they're practices of pure witnessing. But always still the last hurdle for most spiritual aspirants is that I'm still the contemplator.
Yes.
I'm still the one. There's still a separation. There's still spasha.
Is the sense of me experiencing this silence, or me experiencing the peacefulness and this sort of thing. Yeah.
Yes. I haven't attained samadhi, which is complete meditative absorption in Brahman. So that's the final hurdle, right? And that's where most of us get to. We get to that stage and then we can't get out of that stage. There's still a sense of me meditating on Brahman, me, you know, like in the practice of what we would call nidhyasana meditation, non-dual meditation and Advaita. There's still the, there's Shiva and there's me. You know what I mean? Like, even though my mind is completely engrossed and absorbed in it, but I still have an experience of separation or of some more refined form of duality.
Yes. So, what? We have to obviously break that.
Well, we have to merge with Brahman, you know. And obviously, as we mentioned before, Vairagya helps that. Pratyahara, which enhances your dharana, your concentration. And once your concentration is fully, you know, attuned and really refined, then you can absorb yourself in samadhi, in jhana, in meditative absorption, and attain samadhi.
Yeah, the ultimate stage where we there is no longer meditator and meditation, contemplator and contemplation.
The seer and the seen, the experiencer and the experience. First of all, Brahman is not an experience. It's the ever-present substratum, the ultimate reality.
Yeah, complete dissolution of sense of I at all levels.
At all levels. Gone, disappeared. But it's just that last hurdle. It's just that last hurdle, that last little sprinkle you gotta clean.
You are that.
You are that, yeah.
You are Brahman.
Yeah. So you not you know, like there's a lot of sages that will claim I am Brahman, like and it's like no, because you gotta get rid of the I.
There is no I,
like it's a contradictory term.
That is right.
Brahman is non-dual. To say I am Brahman, it means that you and Brahman were once separate.
And you and others.
And from the Advaita Vedanta perspective, from the aspartial perspective of non-relation, you have never been separate from Brahman.
Right.
You've only just, you've invested, you got your money, you went to the cinema and you paid for that based on a fiction story film.
Well, that's exactly right.
And you invested your whole life into that fiction.
Yes.
And you actually believe that as a true story.
You're making your own movies.
Making your own movies, yeah. Mm-hmm. You're watching X-Men and you're thinking that that's actually a real story. And you're like, what? You're crazy, this fella. It's not true. It's a fiction.
Yeah. You were never been separated from it. You were always one with it. Again, there is no such subject in this realm.
No.
Only that presence, only the ultimate truth, and we all are that.
We are all that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's why there's no death, no birth. You are ultimately that pure awareness, that witnessing. You know, you can be dying in an extreme pain, but who's the witness of the pain and the death?
Yep.
There's a witness there. How come the witness itself is unaffected by the process? The body and your mind and your attachments, the whole sparsha realm of relation is under threat in that process, because it's all going away, all the relationships, everything happening is going away, but the awareness is still there. It's still seeing that reality. It still sees those objects of attention. What you've got to do is disentangle yourself from those objects of attention in your life to become a Jivan Mukta. So even when you have your process of death, of dying physically, you won't be attached to the story that you've lived.
Yeah.
That ended a long time ago.
That's right. That's not the story we need to explore, it's the other.
The other, yeah. Mm. There is no story. Exactly. It's not a fiction story.
Yes.
It's a true story.
Yeah.
And that's the story of Brahman. So
true.
We hope you all enjoyed, and we'll see you guys next week.